other things that we need to deal with is to firstly indicate our unhappiness with the public hearings, precisely because of Parliament not doing its own work. And I want to this to be put on record so that, because I want to approach the chairperson of the House to institute some disciplinary measures. Because it can't be that a decision is taken 3 weeks before the public hearings, and management in the institution only conclude 3 days and take a decision only 3 days before the public hearings, and they expect people to be in the public hearings. Because no work was done in making sure that people are properly informed and dealt with. And the reason why I said I want it to be on record, it must be in the minutes, so that I can therefore then approach the chairperson of the House to deal with this specific matter.
I'd like to comment on your statement and rather request that we ask the following investigation before we sort of determine any outcome. It's only worth a strong so I think I would support your position of call for an investigation.
For an investigation. No, I agree with you. We will then therefore then call for an investigation. But I must on record say, when I approach the committee secretary and asked as to why all these things happened at that short notice, I was informed that the whole issue was only approved the Friday before. We went Friday at 3-4 in the afternoon, before we went to the public hearing. And all along I knew that everything else is set, because if you look at the program of the institution, this issue was clearly stated in the program that this is what's going to happen over this particular period. What made things worse for me is the deliberations too. We could not, because of the institution's program, we could not. And unfortunately I was approached by COSATU, the Legal Resource Center, who wanted to come to the deliberations, but it couldn't happen. You are represented here by member. Not yourself. and that's where we stopped another embarrassment for ourselves, precisely because work was not done. Officials are doing as they wish, they are not implementing decisions that are taken by politicians. And I'll therefore, in terms of our own minutes, in terms of our own records, call for an investigation into this matter. Because I personally sat with the deputy manager 2 weeks before. I sat with him indicating the importance of those particular public hearings. And we agreed that he will immediately make sure that everything is being processed. But unfortunately, that did not happen. Having said that, I will then hand over to the department.
Both the code and the regulations for See now, it's common knowledge, the code and the regulations that come from the Legal Service Commission Act of 94. This has been a bit of a delay too. When it was passed, it was just after the interim constitution. Then the new present constitution kicked in, but the JSC Act was never amended to take note of the changes that were introduced by the new constitution. Therefore, we had certain inconsistencies. The cross-references were all wrong. And then the new constitution took care of some of the provisions that was actually appearing in the Judicial Service Commission Act. So those provisions had to be omitted. So that was the first reason for amending the Judicial Service Commission Act way back, or finally culminated in the 2008 amendment. But at the same time, so we had a Judicial Service Commission Amendment Act that was passed in 2008, that was Act 40 of 2008. But at the time, Parliament was seized with the whole concept of the judges' remuneration, and we had to actually replace the whole judges' remuneration act because of the change in term of office of the Constitutional Court judges and some other matters. But simultaneously, the whole issue came to the fore of how do you deal with complaints against judges. We did not have at the time a formal system looking at judicial conduct, judicial ethics, and of course it was unheard of that judges would have to declare assets or registrable interests, those kind of things. So the Judicial Service Commission Amendment Act that was passed in 28 looked at four areas. Firstly, and I'm talking to paragraph 2 of this thing, of this little document, it aligned the provisions of the Act with the Constitution. Then it created a procedure for dealing with complaints against judges. That is again linked to section 180 of the Constitution that says you can, in national legislation, address that issue. Thirdly, it made provision for the promulgation of a code of judicial conduct. And then lastly, expressly saying that there must be provisions relating to the declaration of judges' registrable interests. That just very briefly background of the two pieces of documents in front of you now. But Chair, then I cannot overemphasize the importance that all of this whole legal regime, must always be seen against the background of the Act that governs judges' employment and conditions of service. That is the Judges' Remuneration and Conditions of Employment Act of 2001, 47 of 2001. And the reason why I'm saying that is judges have a very unique dispensation. And you will have noticed it already in the responses coming from the judiciary to the code and to the regulations. They have a unique dispensation in the sense that the regime governing their appointment and employment and retirement is once a judge. It is called once a judge, always a judge. Once you're appointed as a judge, you remain a judge until the day that you die. And every time, and it's always, you feel uncomfortable, people talk about judges on pension and pensioner judges. In law, there is no such thing. You're a judge. You, after a certain period in office, you get discharged from active service. But you're still a judge. You will continue to receive the salary of a judge until the day that you die. As the judge's salaries are adjusted every year, you will receive those salaries. If you retire, I say retire, as a judge of the SCA, for example, and next year there's a salary adjustment for judges of the SCA, you will get the same adjustment. You will always be paid a salary that is equal to those judges who are in active service. The nicety here is, if you choose not to remain a judge, you can actually resign. That means you resign from the office of judge and then you will not be called a judge anymore. But a further nicety, if at the time of such resignation, you've already completed more than 15 years active service, you will still continue to receive a salary for the rest of your life. The only difference being that salary will not be adjusted. So if I resign the office of a judge when I earn 2 million a year, then I will earn 2 million a year for the rest of my life, notwithstanding the fact that I'm not even a judge anymore. So And I'm mentioning this because you will see that this it is repeated in the kind of submissions that come. People object and say, but I am on pension. I am entitled to this. I am entitled to that. Why do I have to declare my assets? Why do I have to ask for permission to do other work? And Chair, I can really entertain you for very long, and I'm not going to do, but the reasoning behind this, let me just very briefly mention it. Where does this concept of judges for life come from? And I may add that in our research, Mr. Robertson can maybe differ from me, I don't think he could. We've not come across a system like this in the world, this concept of judge for life. But it comes from a situation around 1986-87, culminated. The then Minister of Justice, it was Kobekutsia, had a problem. You can imagine it were the days of high apartheid. It was difficult to get people of the necessary caliber to accept appointment to the bench as judges. And at the time, judges also had a very different dispensation. They had a Judges Pension Act with completely different remuneration provisions for once you retire. At that time, you still retired as a judge. So the trade-off he offered the judges at the time was that, look, if you as an SC earning a lot, a very high income, are prepared to accept an appointment to the bench, I will give you this dispensation where you would not have to worry about pension and things like that. So it was a trade-off at the time. Judges got the choice, the serving judges, whether they wanted to stay under the old judges' pension dispensation or whether they wanted the new dispensation. Most of them opted for the new dispensation. And we've inherited that dispensation, and that is just a fact of life. But part of the trade-off at the time was, which they also accepted at the time, is you get this discharge from active service, but if you're at a certain age and we ask you to come and do extra service, notwithstanding the fact that you've been discharged from active service, you must be available for 3 months a year to do extra service. That provision is still on the statute book. It still forms part of the Act. It is not being used very regularly, but in theory, there is always this possibility that if, notwithstanding the fact that you're discharged from active service, you may be called upon to do 3 months a year active service. But the trade-off, again, if you ask to do that, for example, I use Judge X, who has been discharged from active service, and I ask him, please head a commission of inquiry. It will take so many months or so many years. For every day that you do that extra service, you get a double tax. So that is just to put things into perspective. But then the last part of the trade-off was, seeing as you getting a salary, not a pension, a salary for the rest of your life, you are not allowed to do other work. The employer are paying you a salary, that means you're not entitled to do other work. You are still a judge for life. But Chair, it's not for me to express an opinion on the merit of that system. I think it's very much arguable. A lot of arguments can be made both ways, but the reality is that that is the system that we inherited, and that is also the reason why when Parliament, your foreigners considered this legislation, it was a huge point both in the then National Assembly and the National Council of Province. A lot was said about this concept of judges for life. The judges came here to the National Council of Provinces, I remember very clearly, and they had very valid, but they had very strong objections to the fact that they are still, if you look at Section 11 of the Act, they are still required to approach the Minister for his consent if they want to generate an extrajudicial income. They objected to that, but it was passed in that way. And you will find in the Act, this briefing note, if you look at Section... in fact, I think I may have, I've actually not mentioned this particular provision, unfortunately, but it is Section 13, the Principal Act, Section 11, has a provision, Section 12 one rather, Section 11 says that if the minister makes a decision on whether to grant an application for consent to do work other than your judicial income, one of the factors that he must take into account is whether that consent would be against the judge for life concept. The Act uses that terminology, the judge for life concept. So Chief, and I'm sorry for stating, for overemphasizing this, but this is the underlying threat that you will find whenever we deal with the regulations and the objections to the regulations. I want to emphasize, I'm not expressing an opinion on the merits of that, but that's where it comes from. At the time, Parliament felt very, very strongly about those provisions. They felt very strongly about the fact that if one side of the coin means you get a salary for life, the other side of the coin is you do not do other work. If you want to do other work, if you want to generate other income, then you resign and you're free to do it. Even if you resign, you still get the salary, but it won't be as good as that. That just by way of background. Then I'm looking at paragraph 4, the code. Section 12 of the Act makes specific provision for the Code of Judicial Conduct. The relevant provisions are that the code must be compiled by the Chief Justice, who must act in consultation with the Minister, and it must be tabled in Parliament for approval. Parliament may, after obtaining public input, approve the code with or without any changes thereto. And that is, in fact, obviously the process that you are engaged with right now. Turning to the regulations, there are two kinds of regulations that the Act provides for. Firstly, the regulations dealing with the disclosure of judges' registrable interests must be made by the Minister in consultation with the Chief Justice, and it must be approved by Parliament in the same manner that the code must be dealt with. In other words, you can also approve the regulations with or without any changes thereto. Then we get in section 23, a very short provision. Section 23 deals with a list of persons that must be maintained, persons who are not judicial officers and who are suitable to serve on judicial conduct tribunals should those be appointed. And it just says that that list must be kept in the prescribed manner. Prescribed manner by definition means there's a regulation. Then other regulations are dealt with in terms of section 35, that is the general regulation making power given to the minister, and it says that the regulations made under this section, which would include those 23 regulations, must be tabled in Parliament before they're published in the Gazette, but they do not acquire they do not require the approval of Parliament. Now what happened in this instance, Chair, you will note that this comes from 29 already. That was when these matters were first brought to Parliament. And I think that at the time it was anticipated that the process would be much speedier. Unfortunately, what happened is the regulations that was tabled at the time combined those two sets of regulations. In other words, you've got one set of regulations, but some of them need Parliament's approval, whereas other just need to be tabled in Parliament and then it can be gazetted. The only regulations that require parliamentary approval are those dealing with the asset register. Funnily enough, or ironically, the urgent regulations at this stage are those pertaining to that list of persons that must be compiled so that you can appoint a non-judicial person to a tribunal. And we understand that the Judicial Service Commission at this point in time does in fact want to appoint a judicial conduct tribunal. They cannot do so because they require that regulation. So what we're doing at this stage is not to waste your time. You need not look at that part of the regulation at this stage. The only part of this regulation that are relevant to you at this point in time is that part dealing with the asset register, the declaration of registrable interest. The others we will take up. We'll run with it separately, and it can happen very quickly. I mentioned this because you also referred to the urgency of the matter. I think that we will cope with the urgent part in that manner. Obviously, I need not tell you it would be good if the code can be promulgated and become effective. It would be good if the asset register part can also be promulgated, but it is also not as if there's going to be a train smash if it does not happen tomorrow. I understand that the ad hoc committee in the NA has been extended until sometime in August. So yes, it is urgent, but I do not think you need to have sleepless nights or work through your nights at this stage to finalize those matters. Chair, with those words of introduction, we're in your hands. We would like to suggest at this stage that maybe Mr. Roberts look very briefly at the code. Chair, I do not think that we can lecture or even appear to be lecturing the members. Obviously everybody will have to read it and see for himself or herself whether they agree or not, but clearly there are some areas that one would like to draw attention to, and we can maybe assist you with those areas that you would like any clarification or that fancy word elucidation on, Chair. And with that I will give to Mr. Roberts, unless there's any questions at this stage, Chair.
I'm not sure if you can come to the questions before questions that you can go forward.
Yes.
You can just clarify that there.
Yeah.
But we then determine from the process you will be
given. Chair, what has happened so far, you're probably aware of the fact that on two occasions now, a delegation of the judiciary from the judges came to see that committee. They've raised issues of concern regarding the regulations, regarding the asset regulations. There was much less, I do not think there's any controversy about the code. The code is really about grammar, language preferences. Do you want shall or must or maybe none of them? You know, I don't think there's any big issues revolving around the code, but members may well feel that there's something they would like to see in it, or there is something in the code that they would not want to see in it. From the department side, there are no particular issues that we want to raise or particular changes that we're affecting. From the regulation side, the judges are not happy about judges discharged from active service who also have to do the asset declaration. They feel that they should not be doing that. And they've also pointed out that acting judges should not be required to do the asset declaration or the registrable interest declaration. Now, once again, I'm not going to say much about the merit of the arguments there, but the fact is, and that is the difficulty we're facing, the fact is the Act says very clear, there must be this asset register. It must contain the registrable assets of judges in active service, judges discharged from active service, their spouses and immediate family members, it says so in the Act, and acting judges. So it is really difficult to come with an argument that because they have objections we can just leave it out. So that is one of the issues that you have to address. But I think what the other committee, and of course, Chair, I cannot talk on behalf of the NA ad hoc committee, but they've had two meetings with the judges. There is a third on the way. We will, or they will be trying to meet the judges as far as those regulations are concerned. And obviously they must convey whatever they do to this committee so that we can at least be informed about exactly what is happening there. And I'm sure, I'm not a politician, but I'm sure that if there's any political issues, you would want to raise it with your parties in the other house as well.
Chair, I just want to know, I think we've committed
Thank you.
just wanted to get this point that I get the impression that the judges felt because there was such an agreement that she was in touch. No, she'd be for life because it wasn't meant to be for life. Now, for life, the concept is fine, but the content of what is in there for life was this parliamentation. Because we know from the previous system that the judges were, in a sense, almost untouchable. If I can use that word, they saw themselves as the lawmakers and whatever we, or how we view it. But I think it's important that we tell the judges, as many of the other laws that we are changing, many of the systems we are changing, that the judges must also realize that this new parliament is going to deal with it. In terms of fairness and equality, like all people who work for the state, I think that's the principal statement I want to know. In terms of us, I view it, we must have the opportunity to review the packages or agreements that were made for the previous, in the previous government.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it's a very interesting point. Before 94, the issue was dealt with in the Judges' Remuneration Conditions of Employment Act, 89 of 1989. And the Constitution at the time said that the judge's salary may not be reduced, or that Act, 89 of 89. Then the interim constitution came, and obviously, and quite likely, dealing with judicial independence and entrenchment of all those things, it says a judge's salary may not be reduced. Then the new constitution, and this is an interesting difference. Section 176(3) says the salaries, allowances, and benefits of judges may not be reduced. It's in fact wider. May not be reduced, but it means that you cannot. In this instance, may means it may not be reduced. You're not allowed to reduce it. This is what may means in this instance. And it makes for difficulties, you know. This is the Constitution, it's the supreme law. In theory, if the judge's regulations say that if a judge has to travel from A to B and I pay him or her 20 rand a kilo for that, I'm not even allowed to reduce that. If you interpret this strictly, and it's a huge dilemma, and the question has always arisen, why? Why this difference between the interim constitution and the new constitution? I think worldwide it's an accepted and an honored principle to entrench the salary of a judge. You're not allowed to reduce the salary. But this is an interesting deviation from that. Why the allowances and the benefits? Because then what happened, arguments began to arise. What exactly are allowances? What exactly are benefits? And just to illustrate this point, at some stage, in the development of Superior Court's Bill and other pieces of legislation, the whole issue of recess became an issue. Should there be recesses? Should they be shorter? Should the minister consent to recess period, etc., etc.? And an argument arose from those ranks that, but it's a benefit. It's a service benefit. You cannot reduce my recess. I'm not saying it's correct once again, but those are the kind of issues that arise. But just the long and the short of it, I think, oh yes, it was the original agreement was 89. That's why it was at 89 of 89, 1989. But then again, of course, the new parliament in 2001, that carried over the system. So it is all there, and it is entrenched in terms of the constitution. And I think simple answer is, you'll have to change the constitution if you want to review it.
Taking into account the members of the board to another meeting.
criminal.
Yeah. Now, we will give you a chance, but what we will do is for members to go through the documents and stuff. Yeah? And in our next meeting, what we will ask the service of the committee to do is to make a check as to whether the meeting with the other committee members is free, so that we then make it a great committee, so that we don't need separate meetings with that. In one meeting, that will be the best. Also, it will also assist us not to get different meetings. Yeah. That is what we will do now. We will give you to present the proposal first, and then members will go through that. We will make sure that we call you back again to deal with those particular amendments and subject to the feeling of the committee on those particular amendments. But we can go ahead.
Again, I'll try to be brief as possible. Like my colleague said, the code originates from Section 12 of the Act. The code is also one of the grounds on which I think lodge a complaint against a judge in terms of Section 14.4 of the Act. The code basically, the code originated, I think, from international instruments in most countries like America, including some African countries like Kenya, Nigeria, and Zambia. There are codes for judicial conduct, for judiciary, which they must adhere to. Now, I think the document that was used and on which this code is based is the Bangalore Principles of Judicial Conduct, which was adapted from 2002. The code mainly provides for certain conduct to which judges must adhere to, as well as certain conduct that is prohibited. I can quickly try to go through that. The code itself, the documents I've submitted to you actually indicate all the drafting suggestions, so it must be changed. The preamble of the code mainly refers to the Constitution and the Act, and give you a background from which must be taken into account if you read this code. Definition, the original code that was tabled by the judges, didn't have a definition provision. From our side, I think we need to insert a definition provision. The reason, therefore, is that the code is, this code is actually something similar to subordinate legislation. It's a ground on which a complaint may be lodged, so it's got legal consequences. And that is usually the drafting style we follow in drafting subordinate legislation. Application clause, this is on page 3 of your document, basically will tell you the ambit to which this code applies, and it mainly specifies it applies to the judges defined in section 71G of the Act, which includes almost all the judges, well, serving judges, constitutional court judges, appeal court judges, etc. And it also goes further and says it applies to an acting judge as well as a judge not in active service. Well, that's the mainly spells out the application of the code. Interpretation of the code, basically giving you the overview or some principles you need to take into account when you interpret the code. Something that was raised that's quite important here. The code has got certain main provisions, but that main provision is explained by notes. And the issue was raised, what is the status of this note? Has it got similar standing as the main provisions of the code? Is it merely there for explanation and should not be taken into account if you determine whether certain conduct falls within the ambit of the code or outside?
Well, that was raised previously in the National Assembly Committee. We're still busy deliberating on this. Division independence, which basically tells you that the judge is independent. Page 5 of the document, Article 5, deals also with conduct of judges, and it imposes a duty on judges to act honorably. On the next page, again, obligations imposed on judges. First is Article 6, they must comply with the law. It's a general statement, all judges must comply with the law. Article 7 deals with equality. It mainly states that a judge must treat each and every one equal. It restates the equality clause in the Constitution. From our side, the departmental side, we see that the code itself I can use that, it's going to take too long. Okay. Equality, the next clause deal with transparency. Just tells you that all steps that a judge takes in the judicial proceedings must be open for everybody to see. Fair trial principle is all also entrenched in the code. It's certain conduct that must be followed by a judge to ensure that there is a fair trial. Other clause is on page 9, which imposes the duty of diligence on judges. The restraint clause again is the duty imposed on judges to further regulate their conduct. Other clauses on page 11 of Article 12 that deals with association. With this association clause, the issue was raised by the state who advisors. One of the provisions in this code is that the judge must not belong to a political party. According to the state of advisors, that is against the Constitution. We can probably discuss that in a later stage, whether it's applicable or not. And also, the issue whether a judge may belong to a secret organization, that is also against certain rights and things in the Constitution, and the state of fathers also raised objections to that specific clause, which will be discussed at a later stage. Article 13 deals with recusal. Recusal is something that is already entrenched in our law, but it's dealt with here. And the question that was inter alia raised is there a need to entertain this in the code, since the law really provides extensively for the recusal of a judge or a judicial officer in proceedings. Clause 14 deals with extrajudicial activities of a judge on active service, that is current serving judges. That is more or less in line with the Judicial Service Commission Act. It actually states a lot of things that a judge must do and not do. One of the main changes that is proposed by the department is on page 40, paragraph 4C. It refers to a Section 21 company. The Companies Act was repealed in the interim, and I think Section 8 of the new Companies Act provides for non-profit companies. Article 15 and 13 fairly deals with extrajudicial income. It actually basically restates what is contained in the Act. So, no further development in that regard. On the bottom of the page, Article 16, deals with reporting of inappropriate conduct by a judge. Basically, place obligation on judges to report inappropriate conduct by, firstly, member from the National Prosecuting Authority as well as a senior advocate. From our side, or I rather want to raise the question, is it not appropriate that we also impose a duty on judges to maybe report inappropriate conduct of other judges to the Judicial Service Commission? Just a remark from my side. I think that later on I'll discuss it fully. And Article 17 deals with certain obligations that's imposed on judges that have been discharged for active service. We may also restate what is already in the Act. I'm going to get each and everyone. Is there anything specifically that I must suggest? I'll go to it now in more detail. After 10-7 meetings that judges were present, well, I think they all accept the content of the code, they agree with the code, and there's no objection to the code. So from the judiciary side, I don't think we have to fear that they will actually, at some stage, come and tell Parliament that they are not satisfied with anything in the code. Also, the code is already before Parliament, so I believe there was a consultation process between the Minister and the Chief Justice, and that the Chief Justice actually agreed with the content of the code. And, again, I would just point out that in terms of Section 12 of the Act, Parliament might any time amend the code. So it's in the hands of Parliament to amend the code, any provision thereof. And after the parliamentary process, the code must be published in the Gazette.
Maybe one specific issue. Yes. But remember when we were in the movement, the Dutch
Mutant.
They agreed with the court. Yeah. They raised a number of issues around, I think we have told you this is dramatic. Not referring to the declaration and all this, but not in the court.
Yeah. We dealt with that in the proposed amendments that we are dealing the code that was handed out. I believe one of the issues that was raised, if you overall knowledge relate to the Act, it was the reporting requirement that the judge was against, the reporting requirement of the spouses. Why must the judge actually report on the finances of his spouse? I think he has pointed out that his spouse will never give him the necessary information to report on. That relates to the regulations again.
Yeah, I was just trying to find out how the court only.
Yeah.
I think the regulations will be with. Remember, one area that we depend upon is around the actual court.
Yeah.
And maybe also important that it's coming to meet with them because they complain around this
person. Chairperson, I think we are in possession of that document. It was handed out in the National Assembly some time ago. We were actually proposed also certain amendments to the Act to address certain issues. But that again mainly relates to the regulation, not the code itself.
Well, I think that is fine. For today, I think we are fine with whatever we have to do now. I think members of the council will be fine. What I will then check is I will try to then make sure that in terms of the next meeting with the staff, we have a joint committee with the National Assembly. And then we are in 1 week. We will check on our own program of the institution.
And if there are issues that we want to raise with ourselves before we conclude the research, we then come back to the study. For us to yourself to clarify before we go to the study. I'm not sure if the same thing has a meaning. Is there anything else that you think you want to raise?
In fact, as a matter of fact, there is. Being in justice, I just think it's appropriate that every justice official should also have that system of once a salary, always a salary.
Of course,
for the MP. Thank you, members. For today, then we'll be informed of the next meeting.
I'll just call me a bit earlier.
Yes. Last time I was on my way to the airplane.
Thanks.
Good.
Bye.